Doing the podcast over the years has been absolutely fantastic. Obviously, as you know, first of all, it was actually James Kelly did the first couple of podcasts. Then it was Eddie Pearson, and then I was the main sort of guest on with Eddie, and then things evolved, and I'm doing it, and it's been fantastic. The guests we've had on over the years who've given up their time for a bunch of amateurs to ask them some questions, mainly about Celtic, sometimes more generically about football. And the very best guests are the ones that, as you're speaking to them, the more they say, the more questions come into your head that you could ask them. I remember having James Grant in my office, chatting to him for about 3 hours in total and managing to get an hour and a half podcast out of it. But the other thing you're very conscious on is you're sucking in this person's time, and you're also using up your own personal time, not so much of an issue in lockdown. And Andrew Smith, formerly of the Celtic View, Evening Times, Scotsman, whatever, is Scotland Sunday, is one of those guests who the more I talk to him, the more questions I wanted to ask him and the more stories I'm sure he's got to tell. So as you're listening to this podcast, I know there's loads of things that he mentioned that I could then have followed up, but there's loads I also wanted to get out. Fantastic stories. He has agreed he will come back on the podcast. So this is me, Harry Brady, with him, Andrew Smith. So I'm joined now by a guest, a bit like James T. Kirk. He has the middle initial that resonates most when I say somebody's name. So I'm joined by Andrew Smith, or Andrew H. Smith, which is what I've known you most of my life. Why the H?
Oh, it's hellish. No H for hellish, but it is hellish, the very fact I did it. When I started at the Celtic View, I used to think my name was really, really bland. Andrew Smith was really bland. And I'd seen all this, like you have great writers that sometimes have a middle initial. So I stuck in the H, and I retained the H right throughout my career at the Celtic View until the Celtic View get sold off in the dark days of the old board. They get sold off to First Press Publishing, which was run by Steve Sampson, former Scottish Sun editor. Youngest, he used to always tell us, the youngest ever journalist in Fleet Street, started at 17. And under his wing was people would probably know him, Bill Leckie. Mm-hmm. And Bill Leckie said there was a pretentious wee so-and-so, and I had to get rid of the middle initial. So the middle initial went. But by that time, Graham Spears had started. He saw me as some wee kind of diary monkey for him that he could fill the odd space. So he used to write stories about H. He'd spell it A-I-T-C-H. And so he'd write all these, just because we used to chat about daft things that were happening and all that. So people actually knew me as H. Actually, when my wife first went out to me, she told some of her friends that she was going out with this guy, Andrew Smith, and they went, "Do you mean H?" So like, people who didn't know you kind of knew you or thought they knew you. But the H hasn't survived my move to the Times. Or you don't see people with middle initials, do you? I mean, I can understand. Actually, I agree with Bill. It was a bit pretentious.
I once read a thing years ago about people in business in America, or I think it was everywhere, who had a middle initial on their business card were more successful than people who didn't have a middle initial.
Wow. It just looks a bit out of place. It looks incongruous, doesn't it? But I always remember, wasn't so much the middle initial, but Celtic went through a terrible spate during the Terry Cassidy regime. We used to look, there was new appointments made regularly, and we thought, we always had this thing, if your title for your job had three names in it, three words in it, it meant you were hopeless. So they'd bring on this commercial executive director. No, nobody just was just commercial director. They brought on all these idiots. You know, they all had three names in their title, and we knew we were doomed. As soon as we hired somebody and they gave them three names, it was because they were hopeless in every other respect.
So we're going to talk at length about your time
at the Celtic View. But before we start, to get your Celtic credentials for being on the podcast, what was your first Celtic game, and what was your who was your first Celtic hero?
Well, my first Celtic game, I was just like, I'll admit this, is I've done a kind of I love the 80s thing. I've went back and checked, because you've only got scant memories of these things, because I was six at the time, six and a half. And it was the reason why I remember it was because it was the first ever game held on a Sunday in Scotland. Celtic played Clyde Bank in January 74, mm-hmm. and it was during the miners' strike. And at that time, they were moving all the games to 2 o'clock so that they didn't have to use floodlights, because you're similar kind of vintage to me, aren't you? Remember those days, the candles and all that?
Yeah, I can remember. I've only the vaguest recollections, but used to have like drawers full of candles and cupboards full of candles.
Yeah, all the holy candles were stocked up, and you know what I mean? They were selling for a dual purpose. You know, my dad used to, he loved his holy candles, so they kept us going, playing cards. And what I always remember is the wax going on all the playing cards, because it would drip as you were playing cards, you know, and the candle had to be in the middle, you know. So if you...
I also remember my mum sending me out in the street to see whether everybody else's power was out, or whether we were just having... We did a problem with our electrics.
You would just see the wee dot, because when the TV get cut off in those days, poof, it used to just register a wee white dot, if you remember.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because when the power was gone, it's like, oh, no, get the cards out, get the candles out, you know. And so Celtic played on a Sunday, because Clyde Bank had suggested that, I mean, I've just checked this. I didn't even know the background to it, but I've just checked that Clyde Bank had suggested that they could use Sundays, so there would be more time during the day they could play games.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it turned out that when they drew Celtic in the Scottish Cup, they thought this was a good time to actually carry out the kind of like do the initiative of playing on Sundays. So that was my first game, Celtic Clydebank in the Scottish Cup in January 74. Celtic 1-6. Well, I couldn't have told you that. I have no memory of the game. Actually, my most outstanding memories, because I come from Lark Hall. So you'd see everybody at Sunday Mass, and I always remember having only a couple of hours seen them going up and get the Celtic bus, because we had a really good Celtic bus in Lark Hall, one of the original founders of the old association. For all people talk about Lark Hall, but you know, you're going in the bus, and then who do you see? But you see the next days, you know, you see like some luminaries of Celtic to come were on that bus that day, but no memory of the game other than with tickets, we didn't have tickets. Paid in at the front stand, and just when you see football live for the first time, I think whatever people say, it's a disappointment, especially if you're in that front stand, the old front stand at Celtic, because it's the forest of legs.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seems so two-dimensional, and you just see legs and people running around, and there doesn't seem to be any structure to it.
In terms of your memories are odd, play odd tricks, one of my earliest memories of seeing a Lisbon Lion playing was actually Tommy Gemmell as player manager for Dundee.
Oh, right.
And I'm sure it wouldn't be the case, but my recollection, we were in the front of the main stand, and my recollection of him going in for a sliding tackle with someone, and his belly being slightly too big. So you know that way when someone's got a top that's too short for them and their belly's hanging out. Yeah, that's my recollection.
Muffin top, it's the muffin top they call it now, isn't it, with women that do it. Yes. That was the muffin top.
Yeah, that's my recollection of Tommy. My only recollection of seeing Tommy Gemmell play football was the muffin top. But you're right, down. You can't really see down the far end of the pitch very well. And it's also, I still, on those odd occasions when you're walking behind someone with obviously a certain type of cigarette, it was the first time I have vivid memories of smelling cigarettes outdoors.
Oh, yeah. Because you're allowed to smoke inside in the ground and all that then, you know?
Yeah, so sometimes I'll be behind. And also, I used to go to the main stand. Obviously, my dad decided to go there to control three boys. And used to go to the main stand, and guys would smoke pipes. So the other thing, if I ever smell a pipe outdoors, visual flashbacks
you get weird old memory triggers, you know. But I mean, the first game I can say I really remember was the Billy McNeil's last game, the Scottish Cup final 75, mm-hmm. because people of a younger vintage wouldn't know either. But when young people used to go to Hampden, what they would do, their parents or guardians, whoever it was that took them, would take them right to the front and sit them on the wall. So they'd almost they would be sitting in the ash, if you remember, around the white wall. And they would go, they would say, "Are you okay, son?" And then they would kind of truck back to the middle of the ground, and every so often they would come down to see if you were okay. But it was almost that sense of kind of freedom. You know, you were in that amongst 50,000-60,000 people, you know, and in some sort of fashion you were on your own, you know, you had no kind of parental control. So that was quite a thrill in itself. And obviously seeing Billy Chaird, I've got a vague memory of that, but my memories aren't very good of those early times. I mean, first season I was going regularly was the disaster season, 77, 78. Mm-hmm. By then my mum wasn't taking me. She used to kind of take me. My dad wasn't as interested, but my mum was just a Celtic nut, you know, but she'd got a family friend to take us, so they used to take us on the bus, and then they would sit us somewhere, and then they would get their cans out and all this kind of stuff. But one of my few memories is Ronnie Glavin missed a penalty, and people fighting and just burling down the steps, almost like, you know, a cartoon. They're going round and round, you know, like with the legs and the arms and all that, making a round circle. And that's about it. 77, 78 is a fight. Somebody having a can, you know, and Ronnie Glavin, that's it, you know. But so, Tommy Burns was always the one I cut out. I've still got a picture of Tommy Burns that I keep on my desk, which mm-hmm. I bought at Barra's in the late 80s. And I moved to 11 different houses. Like, in a short period of time, you know, up the West End, you move and you're a student and all that. There was only one thing that I always took with me was this wee picture. I mean, But it's a bit of tart, you know, it's a bit of Barra's tart. It's kind of plastic gold and all that, but it just is so many memories now because I've had it for nearly 35 years or so. So it was Tommy cutting out the kind of file on, and you used to love it when you had a file on for Tommy and shooting. It'd always say, "Person you'd most like to meet," and it was the Pope. He always wanted the ones that when players said the Pope, you know what I mean? That was somehow like that gave you some kind of thrill.
So what was it specifically about Tommy as a player that you idolised, or was it just him as a person?
I think there was a bit of both. I mean, obviously his religious convictions. My mum and dad were daily communicants, so that played really well for my mum, and maybe that and my cousin who kind of lived with us, who's like my brother, so he just loved his kind of sleekness. He used to always talk about, he said, "Look at Tommy Burns." He had this phrase, "Great carriage, look at him, great carriage." And it was like this. So, like, well, you're so influenced by the people around you, you mm-hmm. know. So they don't determine, but they, you know, like, especially if you value their opinions and all that and respect them, then you do tend to take on what they say. So it was probably passed down to me, but then it became my thing. And when, oddly enough, when Tommy left, my first home programme was when Celtic played. This is when I joined Celtic. He left a couple of weeks after I joined. And it was crushing to me, because I thought, I may get to know him. You know, and Paul McStay, Paul had introduced me to all the players and all that. And I thought, well, because that was mine, because obviously I'd grown up with Paul and mm-hmm. my family and the McStays and all that. We all knew each other. All Catholic families, like Paul did. It's just the community that you had. And so I thought, that's a great chance to get to know Tommy. And then he went to Kilmarnock couple of weeks later, but his last game coincided bizarrely with my first programme, because Celtic played Ajax in a friendly, I don't know if you remember, and he threw his boots into the crowd and all. But I'd just been left high and dry. There was nobody else at the view at the time, because things had happened and people had left just as I joined. It shouldn't have been leaving just as I joined. But so they brought in some old guy and said, "This is maybe your first journalism job, but this old guy, he'll see you through. He used to work in newspapers, he'll come in." And the guy just said to me, "Look, I'm not interested in doing the programme, so you do this programme." I remember sitting up doing Ajax pen picks to about 3 a.m, crying, you know, my old, cranking it through in my old computer, it's got to say typewriter, you know what I mean, trying to type these things, the Tippex and all that, because all these Dutch names that I wasn't overly familiar with, you know. So, and oddly, Tommy went to Kilmarnock, and at that time I'd kind of fallen in love for the first time, and the girl came to Kilmarnock. So I used to go down to Kilmarnock to watch them. I think they were in the third tier then. Mm-hmm. So I watched. So I used to go and see if Celtic wanted to play in the midweek, because the lower leagues played different midweeks and all that. So I saw quite a lot of Tommy at Kilmarnock. I saw Kilmarnock getting promoted and all that, because it didn't kind of cut across Celtic games. So, and then Tommy come back, and it was kind of weird. Maybe it's never meet your heroes, but I never quite clicked with him. I loved him and all that, and with the greatest respect for him and all that, but I wasn't quite as close to him as I thought I would be. Not quite as close to him as I was to, for instance, Liam Brady or Lou McCarry, or I can't quite explain it. It was, he was under so much pressure, you know, and it was, and it was much easier to get along with Billy Starks. Not that I didn't get on with Tommy, but there was just something, and I don't know if I created it, you know, I don't know if I created it by, this is your idol or something, I don't know, it was a straight
maybe if he was under so much pressure. I mean, you can only imagine the pressure, particularly when you've I don't mean this in a critical way, but when you've lacked the life experience of a manager who's been there with a big club, maybe failed or succeeded with other clubs, yep, and has been through all the peaks and troughs, maybe he was, when you're under that stress, maybe he was just making or was only befriending the people that he was already comfortable with, rather than getting familiar with somebody new.
Yeah, yeah. But he probably got on better with my colleagues, I have to say. By then, I suppose I'd been the editor, so I wasn't quite as in and around doing the interviews. I didn't do it. You know, when it came to Brady, then it came to Billy the first time, and it was Lou, I did the programme notes. So inevitably, you're almost meeting them at least, and then I would do the kind of stuff for them for the views. So, you know, inevitably, you're even meeting them two or three times a week, mm-hmm, you know, just through your work. Whereas I didn't have that regular contact with Tommy quite the same extent, because it would be Joe or Merrill, you know, that was doing down the stuff. And it was just, it was a difficult time, and you felt from everybody loved him, you know, everybody loved him. But you just felt from it, and it was almost kind of coloured almost immediately, because you're talking about him rallying around the people he knew. Well, one of the people he knew, and the first day he came there, Frank Kearney was there, and we took these pictures and did a big back page on it. And then Fergus went ballistic, and we all know about the Celtic Boys Club stuff and all that. So almost that was almost like the relationship with Fergus and Tommy within hours. Mm-hmm. You know, there was difficulties there that were never really repaired, and Tommy was quite impulsive. And I mean, I'll tell you a story. It was just kind of funny, but they were trying to sign Andreas Thom, and they were over in Germany, and Joe was over with them in Germany, and he was phoning back. It was a Monday morning, so we were looking for a front page for the View, and we wanted this new signing because thought it'd been a good one. Is any chance it's going to happen? And Fergus wasn't budging because obviously they were looking for more and more money. I think they'd agreed 1.8 for the transfer fee. Then suddenly they come back in and look for the club that's selling, and look for another 200,000. Fergus's attitude towards that was no. You know, he would just refuse to get into a bidding war. And he would ask Tommy, how much do you think this guy's worth? And if Tommy said 1.8, then when the other team wanted two, he would say, but you told me that's what he was worth, so we don't pay any more than that. Tommy says, It's not like that. And he's on at me, kind of. He's saying, go through and tell him we need to sign this list. How am I going to? How am I going to cut any sway one? But he was getting, it was the same with Ginola, if you remember, all that kind of, you know, that all the summer, and they lost out all these players and all that. And it was just, and they lost out in Petrich to Rangers. I remember that one. And meeting Fergus in the corridor, I went, hey, what are you making this? I thought we could have got Petrich. Hey, no, it's Tommy. He said he was worth 1.1 or something, and he went for 1.3. I said, but that's not the way it works. He said, yeah, it is. You know what I mean? It was like, it's always like, why can't you apply the business principles to football? That's just to do his nothing. Why does football think it's different? So,
yeah, but then I always, not that you're Fergus McCann, but I always compare, maybe because it's my business experience, but I compare buying and selling houses with football. And somebody can come along and say the value of a house is X, but I say the value of the house is what someone's prepared to pay for it. And that's why there's always a negotiation in it, because if I've got a house that I don't particularly, if somebody came and knocked on my door today and offered me a value from price of my house, I'd say, nah, you're all right. But if somebody came along and offered me £1 million for my house, or, you know, a ridiculous figure that's much more than it's worth, you're going to turn around and go, hi, all right, that's worth the hassle for me doing that.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and so when it then comes to, I'm wanting to move, but I'm only wanting to move at the right price, and you're wanting to buy my house, but you're only wanting to buy my house at the right price, there's not a fixed figure that then becomes a negotiation that, well, you initially thought that my house was worth, well, whatever figure, 200 grand, 300 grand, 400 grand, whatever it is, and I'm hoping to get as much as I can. So I then go to 350 when you're at 300, and we reach a price in the middle. I mean, that's the way the world works. Not to sound like Donald Trump, but that's doing a deal.
I know, but Fergus never, that just never sat comfortable with Fergus. I remember the first time I was in Fergus's house, I used to have to go on a Sunday and take the pages initially, because Fergus looked at himself before he got his PR operation to check things, because the first couple of weeks when Fergus took over, we were doing this four-part story about how the takeover happened, and we were doing it all with Brian Dempsey. And it was like, so big pictures of Brian Dempsey. And it was the second week of this story. And he put in a picture that Fergus had asked him not to put in. There was people in the picture. Now, I can't remember the ins and outs of this picture. Fergus said, don't put that in. And I put it in. And Fergus came out. He says, can't you see you've been played? Can't you see you've been played? I mean, what is this? It's all publicity and all this. So he says, so he demanded from that point on that he wanted to see the pages. So he'd taken over down in the Clydeside, you know, there were new houses then. You know the ones that were built in the old Garden Festival set? So he stayed in one of them, which I think Morton Vicourse has stayed in before. This wee pokey flat kind of thing. They're supposed to be new and people pay a lot of money for them, but you go in them, you know what I mean? They're like a box. I always remember going into his house on a Sunday night and the place was reeking of bacon. They just had a bacon butty, right? And he always looked like he was going on the golf course, because he was one of those guys, he wore kind of roll necks, but he tucked them into the front of his slacks. You know, like, that was just, you know, and he would wear kind of fawn shoes, you know, that kind of guy.
Straight out of light entertainment from the late 70s. That's Ronnie Corbett, Jimmy Tarbuck.
And I was like, oh, these guys that golfed, you know, when she golfed.
Yeah,
and so I was looking at the pages, and I'd done this one about players that were leaving or something like that. And there was a thing of it was like the it was Gary Gillespie had just been freed or something like that, and I'd written a story about Gary Gillespie. Or something. He goes, "How's that work?" And it was like Gary Gillespie signed 925,000, sold zero. How's that work? That can't happen. I said, but. Well, he had to be freed. He wasn't worth anything. It's like, because that's the way it does happen in football. But, you know, it's just these things. It was just button up against every principle that he had. You know, I remember one of his great ones was like, because somebody said, you should have done that anyway. Didn't matter if it was right or wrong. He says, and he used to quote Pygmalion, you know, principal, sir, sorry, I can't afford them. You know, because it was, I think Eliza Doolittle's dad was trying to sell his daughter to, and he said, and that was his line in it, principal, sorry, I can't afford them kind of thing. And he always quoted for the treasure of Sierra Madre, but he said, what does it profit a man if he gains the world but loses his soul to gold or something? So he had all these things, all these aphorisms that he used to talk about, but I'm digressing, but that was Tommy. And then so when I think of Tommy, I suppose I do think of the difficult, difficult relationship with Fergus. And
would do you think
young Tommy was then?
Oh, I know. So you talked about that very first picture, which you've reaffirmed something that I'd heard from other people in the very recent past, that pretty much the relationship between Tommy and Fergus broke down right at the beginning because of Kearney and Fergus's understanding and Fergus, so what I've been told, basically, Fergus was aware of this guy from North America and couldn't understand that Tommy, based in the UK, wasn't. And that's why the relationship broken down. Do you think, but do you think part of your problem with Tommy then was you were Fergus's guy? And if the relationship with Fergus was fraught right from the beginning, he's maybe a bit wary of you because of your relationship with Fergus.
I did wonder about that. I mean, I don't know if I got on well with Fergus. I'm not trying to pretend that. I was called Tom Campbell. It was very hurtful. I wrote a piece in the paper about 10 years on for Fergus, and I was just saying about how we would, because you just had to speak to him regularly. I'm not saying I was friendly to him. Nobody worked with Fergus. You worked for Fergus. Mm-hmm. And I was saying I would beg him, because my idea was just bolt seats on the old Celtic Park. Don't spend money on, look at the crowds. You know, I produced all these average attendances. It's 23,000 average. They're all up. You get up to 35,000, save yourself a lot of money. This team needs, you know, the injection. And, you know, go, don't do this, Fergus. I wasn't saying it as someone who was his equal, but I was just saying it as someone, I suppose, the kind of supporter coming through. And I'd put this in an article about 20 years on about how Fergus never listened to you and he was always right and you invariably were wrong. He wasn't always right, but so many times, 9 times out of 10, his hunches were right. And Tom Campbell put in one of his books about me being vainglorious, trying to suggest that I was in the same level as Fergus or something. But so I wouldn't put that out there. I'm not trying to suggest that at all. But you did have a relationship with Fergus because you had to speak to him and he had all these ideas because it was all about publicity. So that here he was, he had a publicity organ, you know, so he wanted to use the view all the time, you know, for ticket sales and all this kind of stuff. That became all these dry stories you had to put in about ticket sales. So you were speaking to him, but I'm not trying to pretend it. I mean, I think I did get on quite well. The first time I was in a court case when he took over at Celtic, I was in a court case. So I'd met him the night before and then I'd met him. They had a thing and I sat in the Hilton Hotel on the Saturday morning. But he'd come round the next week to meet all the staff. And Joe said, look, Andrew, our editor's not here because he's in the jury in a high court case. He said, hey, who's he? He said, you might know him. He said, yeah, I met that guy, Snappy Dresser. You know, because he thought it was so slovenly. You know what I mean? it was like, he kind of knew you because he might have thought you were a bit of an, I mean, this is the oddball. He's the ultimate oddball, but he maybe saw something of the kind of oddball, you know what I mean? Maybe my dress sense wasn't the greatest, you know, I was rather slovenly. So I did wonder about that. Meryl used to always wonder about that because I couldn't quite understand why I wasn't closer to Tommy. I suppose I was quite critical. I tried to make the view a bit more critical. I did try to make it a bit more critical. Because we didn't want it to be seen as the kind of Pravda or... And in fairness to Fergus... allowed us to print critical letters. So did Jack McGinn, for all people say. You had to maybe show them and say, look, I cut a deal with Fergus and Peter McLean that I could have critical letters as long as I had edit replies and I would write something at the bottom of them. And I would kind of, by and large, try to explain it away. So, or take the club's side. But it was so that it was at least that was in there. I mean, Fergus allowed us to print a letter that said, you should go back to Canada, you're no good for this club. I mean, people they wouldn't believe that, or you wouldn't see that. I mean, I used to always say to these guys in other newspapers, oh, yeah, you're Pravda and all that. I said, the guys to the Sun, say, oh, yeah, that was a great critical piece you did with Rupert Murdoch. You know, or the guys for the Record, as it was then, what a brilliant piece you did about Maxwell raiding your pensions when he was still alive. You know, these guys, you know, the publisher. How many places do you ever see the publisher rubbished?
Well, I remember being at a fans forum once where somebody was saying that to get rid of the likes of the Clyde phone-in and Sports Sound, Celtic should do their own phone-in stuff. And Peter Lowell was at it. Peter was saying, no, we couldn't. No one would listen to it. And the guy's like, no, we... And you often think, have you thought this through? Have you thought this through for more than 5 seconds before you opened your mouth? You patently haven't. The guy's like, no, people would listen to it because they'd be getting the information straight from the club. And Peter said, but what if we lose? what's the phone in going to be on a Monday night when we've lost at the weekend? Ah, blah, blah, blah. But we couldn't have the official club media slaughtering the manager and slaughtering the player. Oh, but you could allow people to do that. And I'm sitting there thinking, no, you can't. I mean, can you imagine picking up a BMW magazine and the new 5 Series is not as good as the E-Class Mercedes? You know, it's just not.
I don't know what lives beneath the surface, but I always remember, like, in terms of the Gerges' willingness to accept criticism, I printed this letter. It said, Fergus McCann hates Irish fans, doesn't care about them, just wants our money and nothing else. Well, there's no travel arrangements put on for us. There's no way of getting Celtic Park. Nobody thinks about the great journeys we have to put in to get here. And so I put an edit replies. I said, it's okay. I've spoken to Fergus and he's going to build a monorail from your home in Donegal all the way to the east end of Glasgow. Right, and then I felt a bit guilty for it, but it was like sometimes I couldn't resist doing the joke and all that. I thought, I've still got the letter in, even if I'm being rather kind of arch after it. But about a year and a half later, it was Peter Grant's testimonial weekend in Ireland. So it was like there was a night in Derry, and then they were up to Letterkenny, and then it was the same weekend, I think. There was a whose testimonial was it? That Celtic were playing the Republic of Ireland in Dublin. But anyway, so Peter asked, Peter's testimony committee said, do you want to come along? We never get invited to those things. A lot of people didn't care about it. Peter Grant was so different, and Paul was as well. And like, remember Paddy Bowners, we did all this work for his programme. They said, oh, you can get a table. And then for the dinner, oh, I said, that's really kind of you. So you can have a Celtic View table. So we came along in the night. And I think it was the tree thing. What was it called? What it used to be called again?
There was the ski and do in. Is that the one?
I think it is. What was it even before that?
There was the ski and do in, and there was was it the hospitality in as well?
Hospitality in, I think it was.
Yeah.
So there was this week in a card table. If you know what the layout is for that, you know, there's the big kind of conference kind of suite. And there's a bar and there's like double doors.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned up and said, the Celtic View table. Then, what? Oh, no, hold on, wait a minute. So they wedged open the two main doors, like, and they produced this card table and put a kind of sheet over it. So we actually weren't in the hall, right? they tried to angle it so you could see a bit of the top table. Oh, thanks very much, Paddy. Sorry. So Peter was very different, and that was the only time we'd ever. He said, no, we want to thank you and all that. And like, you know, it was your man for cars. For people's cars. What was his name again? He was a good guy. He was a good guy, the club sponsor of those terrible strips, a lot of the terrible strips and terrible times. If you always associate people's, it's funny how you do associate a sponsor with certain grim periods. But anyway, there was a functioning Letterkenny pub for Peter, and it ran on, and I ended up chatting away and all that, and all the players, like a couple of, there was a smarter than Celtic players and then some other people that were kind of along for the ride sort of thing. So there was a bus to take us back to the hotel, and I ended up chatting to somebody, missed the bus. So I said to the guys behind the bar, how do I get to this hotel we're in? I said, oh, you'll need to walk for ages. I said, just go all the way down that street. And suddenly the street forked. And there was nobody there, except I saw this wee guy with a Celtic strip on. And I thought, right, I'll ask him. I said, look, you wouldn't happen to know how I can get to this hotel? He said, yeah, follow me. He said, I'm going down that way anyway. I said, oh, I can see if you're stripped. You're a Celtic supporter, or do you ever get to the games or anything like that? I said, oh, my name's Andrew. I said, I'm here over. I'm the Celtic View editor. Oh, I said, you put an answer in a letter to me. You know, there was only three people, right, out in the middle of the wilds of Donegal. He said, you said that the club should build a monorail for my house, right? And I thought, like, I'm just here on one. The wee guy was about 17, 18 or something like that. Like, quite tall as well. And I'm really sorry. That was too smarmy and all that. He said, you know, no, I thought about it. I was being a bit uppity myself, thinking that, like, the Irish fans weren't accounted for. So it was bizarre, you know, of all the people in all the places at all the times.
So let's go back to the start. How did you get into being a journalist. How did you get into doing the Celtic programme that you first talked about? How did that all come around?
Well, it was the first time I'd signed up. I just graduated, got my honours English for Clyde, the summer of 89. Mm-hmm. And I was coming back for the job centre, and then I popped in, bought the Celtic View, and there was an ad for editorial assistant. So I applied for it. I applied to be the editorial assistant, and Kevin McKenna was the editor then.
Right.
My referee, this is maybe nepotism, but I have to be honest. I'd been an altar boy, one of the longest serving altar boys in our parish. So I got on really well with the priest, Jack McGinn. Karen McGinn. So who just happened to be Jack's brother.
Uh-huh.
So he was my referee on my thing. So then I get interviewed by Jack. So it was Jack's brother, was my parish priest. And he was a good family friend and all that. And as I say, he used to give me money. You know, I used to serve the altar on a Friday night. And he'd say, where is Celtic playing tomorrow? Andrew, I said, oh, we're at Kilmarnock. He said, well, here's for the sports bus. And he gave me a couple of pounds to go to the games and all that. So Jack said, oh, I know as a character, obviously my educational. I had no experience in journalism. I'd written some reviews for the Strathclyde Telegraph was the newspaper, but I fell out with them when they refused to print. I did a piece about, do you remember when the CS gas canisters got thrown at Easter Road?
Mm-hmm.
Celtic played. I did a big piece about that, and they said that it was too slanted or whatever. There's all these Rangers supporters might say, oh, like nothing ever changed. But so they refused to print it, so I fell out. And I've been writing reviews of gig reviews and all that, the Soup Dragons and BMX Bandits and all that. But then I fell out. But that was my only experience of writing. So then Jack and Kevin interviewed me. And Big Kevin said, I think you've got the job. And I was supposed to start 3 weeks later. And then suddenly I got a phone call saying, look, Kevin's left. So can you start earlier? Because there was nobody in the view. So just, I swear to God, this is God's honest truth. So they sat me and they said, the view office is over there. There was nobody there, right? I was just myself. They said, just sit in that desk. And I just sat there and looked about the office. And I was looking in the book rack and all that. And then at the bottom of the book rack, there was a biscuit tin. I kid you not. There was a biscuit. I swear to God. It was a Pekins original. I still remember it. But so you opened it up. And what it was it held all the old...
It was all the gate receipts from the extra 1,000.
It was all the wee green books. That's where they kept all the wee green books. That was as much as a file as we ever had, you know. So that was I found a biscuit tin on my first day at the Celtic View.
So you're in there and... What's it like? Because that is just the period when all the sack the board stuff is starting to really kick in. You know, we were critical of the board prior to Souness's arrival at Rangers, but it was critical in terms of they're probably not very good. You know, there wasn't any concept of their lack of business acumen amongst the support until Rangers went to really ranked it up. And we suddenly realised how pish our board were. So what was it like being in at that time?
It was fascinating. It was endlessly fascinating. As I say, my period at Celtic was one of the least successful periods in the club's history, but it was undeniably the most dramatic. You know, these EGMs that went on at 12 o'clock at night and all this kind of stuff, and you just never knew what was happening from one day to the next. But my first day, the day I started, I got off the bus and I went in the paper shop, and the front page was about what I thought was going to be my Celtic View editor in the Sun. The front page was an expose about my Celtic View editor in the Sun. The back page was Roy Aitken putting in a written transfer request. And page three was about Mo Johnson singing the sash at a Rangers supporters function. So that was that set the tone for, and that was how it was for me in the next 9 years. That was... Somebody was telling me something there, you know, that was the way it was going to be, you know, froth, you know, like kind of.
Maybe the UK government should draft you in to deal with the media handling of the COVID-19 crisis. You've been well trained.
they did draft me, and it's like unbeknownst to me, even about 3 months ago, because that's been pretty shambolic as well. But the thing about it was, is I always remember Gary Gillespie used to call me Jonah. He actually started refusing to speak to me, so we'd speak to him. We did this piece with him before Celtic played Rangers. We had to do it early. The famous Mars bar. I mean, I saw that Mars bar clanking off the head of Kevin Kelly. Celtic were 3-0 down.
That's right, yeah.
29 minutes. And then, the day before that, I'd done this piece of
Gary. Do you know, I was in the jungle that day, and I see if Rangers had got another. The jungle on Mars would have just gone. Would have just gone right across the pitch.
Yeah. It was that close. Because Celtic actually clawed their way into it. And should have had... And, Goff should have been sent off for pulling back. So one and only time I shouted in the press box, and Ken Gallagher said he was going to get me barred for the press box because I jumped off my seat, shouted B at the referee because I think Celtic had pulled it back to 3-2.
Mm-hmm.
Nicholas was going to be through and goal and get yanked back. And I think Thingy was on a booking, Goff or whatever was on a booking. I can't remember if it was Goff or Browner. They were on a booking and they never got it. But the day before that, we'd done this piece about how Celtic had a rock-solid defensive unit with Gary Gillespie. I don't know if it was Gillespie and Mowbray or whatever. And we were going to use it on the Monday. I did say to Donald, because Donald Cowie was the editor by then, and taught me everything I knew, and he was a brilliant influence, just an amazing influence and a great guy. And he came in within a couple of months of me starting, so he was a proper journalist who'd been Baron Furness. And, you know what I mean? He was absolutely clicky. A man for detail, you know, and a really principled fella. So it was a great to work under him, you know, and really learn the ropes. But we'd done this piece where it was how they hadn't lost. Celtic hadn't lost a goal going into that game. Some like in 9.5 hours of football, they were actually. If they'd won that day, people forget this Lou McCarry season. If they'd won that day, they'd gone at some like a point or two behind. They'd been right in it. Predictably, as used to always happen, they lost it, and then they lost to Oldham Partick the next weekend, and then it was all bets are off. So it came in on the Monday. We couldn't use it. We couldn't actually use the piece. And Gillespie came right up to me and went, "You're a bloody Jonah. You're a Jonah." And he was refusing to speak to me. And he just used to call me Jonah. And he was kind of right. I left Celtic. And then 2 months later, they won the league for the first time in 10 years. And I'd been there. I joined just after as they started their 6 years without a trophy.
So you're there, things start to go. Did it feel like there was a siege mentality at the club?
Yeah, I mean, it was like people coming in, and I mean, when I started, remember, it was still, was Michael Kelly in by then? Was he in by then, 89? Then they started bringing in people like David Smith and Terry Cassidy, and that was a horrible time, Terry Cassidy. So they were trying to modernise. They were trying not to lose control. So they were bringing a layer of what they thought was professional executives, which would save their skin. And it wasn't necessarily their fault, but the professional executives turned out to be hopeless executives. Maybe it was a basket case that no good executives would ever... Because... We'd never take on. I mean, because the thing about it was, I'm not defending the old board, but seeing you think, and the first person who defends them is Liam Brady, about how they gave him the money to spend. He just didn't spend it wisely enough.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you look at Celtic spending in the early Brady years, it's not that different from Rangers in terms of, you know, you're spending 1.5 on... Stuart Slater, you know, you're spending £1 million on Mowbray, you're spending £1 million on Gillespie. These are only no mark players. You wouldn't be able to bring these players to Scotland now. Put it that way.
No, I often wonder now, looking back, you know, Stuart Slater. I know some people just think he was useless, but I actually think he was a better player than he looked at Celtic. Gary Gillespie was not completely, you know, it wasn't like we got a guy who was completely past it.
No.
And when you look at the team, I often wonder whether one part of the issue is football is a game of weakest links. So it doesn't matter, you know, you bring these players in, but if you've got some real crap also within it, that's where the problem is. but also wonder whether just the whole atmosphere around everything to do with the club was on such a downer that it was really difficult for people to elevate themselves above that.
I did think, I used to say to Liam Brady, I said, you'll never get it right until they get it right behind the scenes. And in fairness, he used to disagree with me vehemently. Like, because he said, I can't use that as an excuse. I said, but things will just never be right. And people like Paul and Peter Grant and all that, because they were supporters as well, you know, they carried a sense of that. And that, mm-hmm. you know, they almost carried a sense of that. Maybe they carried a sense of that on it. The pitch, you just thought it wasn't meant to be. There was a dysfunction that just couldn't be sorted by even a half-decent team. And Brady had a half-decent team, played some great stuff. Second half of his first season. You know, when Charlie was like, it was all kind of clicking again for Charlie. I mean, they were brilliant until that semi-final in the Scottish Cup, which was almost the mirror image of what happened in December. Like, Rangers think that, you know, like, and they did. Rangers didn't get any breaks in December and, you know, a missed penalty and all the rest of it. That was it in reverse. You know, like, and Celtic down to 10 men and all that, because like, that happened, that was what killed it. That was what killed the Brady. It was that April semi-final. Don't know if you remember it, the rain-soaked night. Davey Robertson gets sent off in about two minutes.
Yeah.
For tackling Joe Miller. Paul hit the bar. Like, the Celtic absolutely pummeled Rangers. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't break them down, because 2 weeks before, they'd taken them the school at Ibrox, if you remember that, when they'd beaten them 2-0 at Ibrox. Mm-hmm. And Nicholas was brilliant. And after the game, Mowbray'd said, oh, the Rangers started playing high balls and that's meat and drink to us. So Walter, in his inimitable way, after Rangers won the semi-final, it was 10 days later, he said, go and ask Tony Mowbray if it was meat and drink tonight, you know. Which Tony Mowbray didn't mean it that way, but... Sorry, again, I'm digressing, but you're like, but there was just certain points, the pressure points, Celtic, as we're kind of seeing Rangers doing now, it's hard to get out of that, you know. That.
Yeah, because it is that thing of the fans are geared to, you know, the opposite of where we were under Martin O'Neill and under Brendan Rodgers and things like that, where the fans are geared to, if you have a setback, it's okay because we'll right ourselves here. That's just a blip. Whereas when you're in the other mindset, the minute you have one bad result, see, I told you, I knew this was going to be the case, and the fans immediately pile the pressure on and the players can feel it on the park.
Although, I have to say, if I can disagree with you respectfully, like, you think about the way Celtic supporters were after that loss to Rangers in December. To me, that Neil Lennon's tolerated as long as Celtic are winning, and as soon as I'm not winning, people think, I get it for people I know and all that, and it's like, for God's sake, you know, I did it for my cousin and all that. Ah, oh, that's it, typical. Like, no good, you're only beating the likes of Hamilton, St. Mirren and all this. So Lazio didn't count. It's just everything after that game. The fallout for that game was...
Honestly, you know, we were more goals, you know, I kept putting up things because you then had that period after the New Year game of no football. I kept looking at stuff and going, no, this is up there in the top three seasons this century in terms of goals scored, points, everything, and you moany bastards are complaining. And it was simply because Rangers were close to us. That's why everybody was so stressed.
But
people were saying things like, we're going backwards. No, because that's why I kept saying, no, this is one of the best seasons this century. They're well above where they should be, as was proved immediately after the winter break. Yeah. They reverted to type.
There's a neurosis among Celtic supporters that I just can't quite get my head around, and it doesn't warm you to the support now. I remember when Tony Mowbray came back, he said, what happened to the Celtic support? I said, Tony, the Celtic support that you knew and you were playing for, it was the hardcore, the 14,000, mm-hmm. the 15,000. They just love their club. They're not overly critical because they just want to be there for them. They're supporters. Fergus Schell say, hey, there's a big difference between supporters and fans. Supporters support. fans of fanatics, you know what I mean? Like so, like, but like, so like, so that he knew the 15,000, but then there was 50,000. Mm-hmm. So he didn't know those other 35,000 that say, right, entertain me, win the way I want you to win, do everything I want, or you can take a hike. You know, because he said they've changed. I said, no, they've changed. It's just, it's like that faction is almost kind of drowned out by the no fair weather. I'm not saying anybody's fair weather, but the guys who want to be watching Celtic winning rather than just want to be watching Celtic.
No, they don't want to watch Celtic winning. They want to watch Celtic winning playing like Brazil 1970.
Yeah. They've got unrealistic expectations.
And if there's one week when we're doing the 9 in a row Chronicles podcast. We're reviewing the first 9 in a row and then we're going to review the current 9 in a row when that's completed. And I keep looking at runs of results that that Jock Steen's teams had. You know, I've just done season 60. We've just done, recorded it yesterday, so we're up next week. Season 68, 69. We had a run of results in the December, January that honestly people would have been wanting Steen sacked in the modern world.
Yeah.
In a season where we win the treble. We draw three games in a row and then we only play Rangers twice and we lose to Rangers both times, the second time being January. So we start the season with a, in 68, 69, beating Clyde. Then we lose to Rangers and draw to Dunfermline or something like that. So out of the first three games, we've won one, drawn one and lost to Rangers. Everybody in the modern world would be going mental. Steam must go. You know, Lisbon was 3 years ago. He's got to go.
Oh, I know. Like, it's just everything, I suppose, the pace of life, everything's just, apart from this period where we're all kind of having to sit back and, you know what I mean, take a pause, but you know what I mean, just the fast pace of everything, that has to be that turnover of news, that turnover of kind of emotion almost, you know, it's everything now, just at breakneck speed.
Well, because I'll get onto that in a minute as a current day journalist, but what was Terry Cassidy like? Because I went to a couple of the Save Our Celts meetings, one at Shettleston Town, is it Shettleston Town Hall or whatever it is that's now demolished, doesn't exist. I remember being there and the look of disdain, to be fair, there was some people stood up and you thought, oh, what a stupid bloody question that is. But the look of disdain in Terry Cassidy's face, to be fair, he was there, but then he was looking at people like, I'm only here, you're biddies. What was he like?
Well, that's what it was. I mean, I didn't have that many dealings with him, I have to say, because he wrote all his own stuff and all that. You know, there was these great big kind of 10,000 word missives, you know what I mean? It was like Kim Jong-il, you know what I mean? It was just like, here is the address. I mean, that's when the view was, if it was just kind of mouthpiece that, you know, like would broach no kind of criticism. It was during the Terry Cassidy regime, because he thought, actually, he'd come from a kind of newspaper background, but he'd obviously never been in the position where he would be controlling editorials. So these people just get quite intoxicated by a sense of power in a way as well. But he brought in someone above Donald because obviously he didn't like, probably, you know, you think, I want my message controlled here. So he brought somebody above Donald as a editorial, whatever it was, you know. Donald was supposed to be still the editor, but then there was this guy above him. These people will never lasted 6 months or whatever, you know. Either they didn't like it or they just, people saw through them, you know. So it was, I wouldn't say I knew him very well. I had to go over and do a couple of things with him, but then he was kind of critical of Billy and all that. And in fairness, Billy's last season was abysmal, you know, like this. You can feel sorry about the way it was handled, about him leaving, but honest to God, that was the first time when the first protests came. People forget this now. It was at the end of a three-game period at home. Celtic never created a single chance across the 270 minutes. Never happened before. They lost to Motherwell and then the pitchforks were out, mm-hmm. You know, at the front door. And that was the start of it. That was the first time we'd ever seen any kind of dissent of that type. So that's you looking at January 91. So that took for January 91. That was it for the next
3 years.
Three years then.
How was it for you running that towards the end? when you must have sensed, you know, must have been like being in Ceausescu's Romania or something, writing the paper then. You know the end is nigh, but you've still got Ceausescu as your boss. You know the end is nigh, but you're still the trade paper of the club. How's that right at the end?
It nearly closed at that time because obviously it was a loss-making operation, so that's why they sold us to First Press Publishing. So by the end of it, I wasn't working for Celtic.
Right.
Bizarrely. Wasn't working for Celtic. I was working for First Press Publishing. And what happened was, Steve Sampson, he's like, he's like one of these fast-talking industrial language kind of like Fleet Street guys. And what was happening was we were getting interviews in the Celtic View and the First Press Publishing to recoup some money because they'd bought us.
Mm-hmm.
They were selling them onto the papers. And Donald got a true partner with Alex Ferguson, all about his dad running a Celtic sports bus and all this, right? It was great stuff. That was the first stuff that came out. It appeared in the Record before it appeared in the Celtic View. And Paul came to us and says, hold on a minute. All our stuff's appearing in the national papers. And away, it wouldn't necessarily, everything appears everywhere now, doesn't it, within 2 minutes? But in those days, it wasn't quite the case. So the players went on strike. They refused to speak to the Celtic View. So we didn't have any cooperation for the players. So we went to Steve Sampson and says, what do you want us to do here? You know, like, if we haven't got any player contact, you'll need to. So Steve Sampson, Paul went up to meet Steve Sampson and they had to make a solemn promise that stuff wouldn't get sold onto the... Because they were almost treating us like PA, like PA copy. You know, you'd place it in different newspapers. So that was really difficult. And then when Fergus come back in and discovered that we weren't owned by Celtic, he wanted to buy us back. But before he bought us back, it was about 6 months because I think he was probably haggling over the price, to be honest with you. I think Steve Sampson maybe ultimately had to give him it as a goodwill gesture, because he wanted to be in with the new regime and all that.
I thought probably because he was so fed up with Fergus, I can't take another phone call from that guy.
So they did all these tabloidy things that Fergus hated, you know, because it was just tabloid subs and all that. It was tabloid design guys and all that. They'd come in on a Monday to work for The View, and then they would go to their shift in The Record or The Evening Times or whatever after it. So one of the things he particularly hated was wobs. Now, a wob is when you do white type in a black box you'll do a wash, you'll do a different colour. So it won't be black text on white, right? So they used some putrid yellows and all that. I used to ban. I said with the wob, if you're using a yellow wob, it's got to be a 20% wash in terms of how strong the yellow is, because they just thought that it was this eye, you know what I mean, yellow green thing, mate, and they're actually yellow and green together. It's not a great colour for your eyes. So I said to them, Fergus, what he doesn't like puns. I've got what it takes. You know, I've had my fill for Phil O'Donnell and all that, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't like puns and he doesn't like wobs, so don't do them. So then I would go up my Monday to check the pages. Is there anybody listening to me here, right? And it's like, look, they almost saw me. You're not the proper editor. We'll edit it properly once we get here. I said, I am the proper editor because it's me that's got to get my arse kicked, you know, when I go back to see Fergus. I said, and so I phoned up Steve Sampson, and I said, Steve, this just isn't working. I said, I can't serve two masters here. And Steve, and he's an inimitable man, I said, listen, you little philosophical cat, right? Get your arse down here. We're going to talk about it. Because that's the way it was. It was all that brutalising you. People see these days in terms of how you talked at the workplace and all that. See these old guys from Fleet Street. They've been the last 2 minutes. They would be up, you know what I mean, on harassment charges and all the rest of it. You know, but it was almost like, because I quite liked Steve, and it was like, it's not often you get called a philosophical C, you know, but like, I was almost kind of laughing at the end of the phone, even though it was a dreadful thing to say to me. But so Fergus brought us back. So he bought us back. And we did an interview, me and him did an interview when he talked about, people forget that it was David Murray's newspaper that first took Fergus McCann seriously. If you remember the Sunday Scot?
That's right, yeah.
He was in it. He was in one of the early editions saying, this is my blue green print for Celtic. And his idea then was to pay for them to do up a new stand. He would get the money for, he would get some kind of cut of it. It wasn't the full takeover plan at that time, if you remember, which would have been about, was it 1991? So
yeah, right at the beginning, Fergus had come along and more or less just offered to give financial assistance to Celtic, more or less.
He did, aye.
And some business input.
Business input. He'd gone to Jack. But then he'd stepped it up. And so we did this interview at the end of his first season. That was 94. It was May 94. And he'd sat down. And we went, it was lunch in the Walfred, and it was like, I'd had my pad and all that there, right? And he ate really quickly, so I was chatting away and all that, and I was just sitting, and he was going like, eat faster, right? Like, he was always a man in a hurry, right? So you have to wolf down this, so we got to this thing, you know, and there was somebody come in who was an executive in his board, right? Who came in, he sat down, before he sat down in his seat, he took his jacket off. And Fergus goes, look at that. I said, what is it? He said, man's an ignoramus. He's an ignoramus. Because his thought was that, I don't know if this is how it is with restaurants, but he said you're supposed to keep your jacket on. You don't take your jacket off in a restaurant.
You're not supposed to take your jacket off until somebody's toasted the Queen, is the old way that it used to be.
In fairness, I don't think that was Fergus's thing. Like,
no, but the principle was, or unless the host took his jacket off.
Was that it? Right. But he looked across and said, the man's an ignoramus, you know. Like, it's not a word you hear often either. But anyway, so we got into this interview, and I was going over to Canada next week because Celtic were playing in this mad cup in Ontario, the Hamilton Cup. So I had to write it. This was the day before I went, and it was all about, the old board stonewalled me, they lied to me, da-da-da. He was just giving it plenty. Because his early months weren't he? It was difficult, you know, he was trying to organise the move to Hampden and all that to get things started and everything. So I faxed this interview through for a hotel in Ontario, and it went in, they lied to me, they stonewalled me and all that. And I talked about the discredited directors, that's the way I described the old board. But because they were jazzing it up in first press, so they changed discredited to disgraced, right?
Hey.
And they ramped it up, and Michael Kelly decided to sue. So he was suing for, he sued me as the writer. He sued me as the editor. He sued Fergus as the guy making the comments. And he sued Celtic. No, he sued, I suppose, he sued First Press. As the publisher, because this was just before we come back on. And he said, you need to get a lawyer. That's right. How much will that cost? I said, cost probably a couple of thousand, because we'll need to, this is quite difficult. This is going to take us a long time. And because, even though I was presenting Fergus the way he once presenting him the words he'd said, he wouldn't pay for my lawyer. I mean, at that time, Celtic View, I was on 13, I was doing 60 odd hours or 13 grand a year.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't pay for my legal costs. He said, no, I'm not your publisher or whatever, but we're just about to come back on to the club. So Steve Sampson says, Steve paid for my legal costs. And I couldn't wait for my day in court. I had this idea about, you know what I mean, in the front page of the Evening Times and telling all these things, like kind of what was happening under the old board and all that. And then Michael Kelly, in one of his rare moves, hit upon the great idea of calling up Elspeth, who was working for the club, working for the old board. That's how Fergus met her, his ex-wife, you know, Fergus's wife, that he's got his children with and all that. I know they're not together now, but so Michael Kelly hit upon the great idea of calling up Elspeth to testify against Fergus. her betrothed. So the one and only bloody court case that was ever settled out of court by Fergus, the one and only one he ran from, which he used to run headlong towards court cases, litigation, was the one I thought I was going to get my day in court. And then I was going to be able to tell it all. Get my front page. Get me in the front page of the Evening Times.
I mean, he'd have won it. But he obviously just didn't want Elspeth involved in it.
Exactly. What a great tactic, you have to say. What a genius tactic to call up his wife-to-be.
So,
no willing to pay my fees. That's just him. It's just business.
I told someone about you're going to be in the podcast. So they said to me, ask him about Michael Kelly trying to sue him. And the other thing they told me to ask you about was how you ended up in the dugout.
Oh yeah. Like that was a Lou McCarrie was brilliant. Lou McCarrie was. He was fantastic with me. He treated you like a real insider. You know, like I felt quite kind of friendly towards him, even though times were tough and all that.
Can I just say that actually, Lou McCarrie had, from a supporter, from an outside perspective, Lou McCarrie was so intrinsically associated with the old board. And then, of course, with Fergus calling him Luigi and all that stuff, he just never had a great... Subsequently, over time, I have had a much greater appreciation of Lou McCarrie as you start to hear more tales about him. So, carry on.
On a human level, you know, that was it was the closest I ever was to a Celtic manager. Even though, when you think about it, Tommy there for 3 years, just we were taught earlier, Lou there for 8, and we were really close. Like, and I had this idea of it, wouldn't it be great to go in the team bus and just take pictures, you know, for the... when Murray banned the Celtic supporters. Mm-hmm. I said to Lou, would it be okay to come in the bus? Will you, like, we can do the kind of, I was part of the thin green line, is that's what they decided to call it. And it was, so remember the directors weren't going. There was nobody going. There was, I think it was 15 players went and the two hamper boys. That was all that was on the bus. And I says, can I go on the bus? He says, don't just come in the bus. He said, come down to Seamill the night before. He said, you can stay over and get your, you can hang out with us there. And I went, ach, nah, that's not a place. That's not a place I should be in. But if I can come to Seamill so that I'm on the bus journey and I'm taking all these pictures. He said, aye, fine. He says, you can sit in the dugout. And this was because it happened a few weeks before. Bizarrely, within that time, the SFA changed the rules that there was only 8 appointed people that were allowed in the dugout. And they all have to have the official, they all had to have an official title. So I wasn't actually allowed in the dugout. I had to stand behind it. The two hamper boys, one of them was Michael Craig, if you remember him. Remember the, it was like, yeah, I think he would only play for Aberdeen. He was a lovely wee guy.
Oh, yeah.
He was a good player as well. Just a lot of young players were never going to take root in that kind of, you know, like a fallow soil that was Celtic then, you know. Mm-hmm. But So I was in the dressing room before it. And I mean, it's a really weird thing. Like when you think, I don't belong here. But then I went out onto the pitch before the game started and all that. And because Barry Smith says, because I covered a lot of reserve games, so I knew Barry. I love Barry bits. And so Barry's kind of testing the turf, you know. And I'm just, as I'm at the course, I'm just pressing down on it, you know, my brogues. What the hell are you doing? I went, oh, well, I'm just doing what you're doing. He said, but you're not going to be playing on it. What does it matter to you? How soft or firm it is. And I'm like, but you know, you see them walking about, the hands in the pocket,
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff. And it was like, and they went back in the dressing room and they hand out the chewing gum, you know, when they're given the kind of, because people get nervous and all that. And they're handing out the chewing gum. And Carol Mulgott says, you better have a couple of bits of this. He says, because you look more nervous than the rest of us. You know, it was like, because it's something you know, you never expect to experience that in your life. You know, Celtic game. So I walked out the tunnel, I've got a picture, I took all these pictures, just take pictures all the time. It's me, I'm walking out alongside John Brown. You know, John Brown's at the other side of me. You know, as I'm looking at this kind of, and then you go and stand behind the dugout. And all, this is when Celtic scored, me and Michael, and I can't remember who the other boy that. We started jumping up. We said, well, we celebrate a goal here or no celebrate a goal. But the emotion, you know what I mean, gets away from you.
Yeah.
Going in. So we're celebrating this goal. and I hear this clank, and there's this spanner landed right beside me, right? So, and I looked behind me, and there was two Rangers two guys in boiler suits, two kind of obviously backroom kind of people, you know, like kind of stadium kind of, and he was just kind of half smiling. He'd thrown the spanner at me, right? And utterly bizarrely, about 15 years later, a friend of mine comes from Dumbarton Way. He phoned me up. He said, "You'll never guess who I've just met." He said, "A guy who said he threw a spanner at you, like a 1994, in April 1994. He was a maintenance man, that was the phrase I was looking for. He was a maintenance man at Rangers. I said, "Did he own up to it?" He says, "Aye." He says, "Because not only did he own up to it, he said he'd no qualms about you deserving it if the spanner thrown at you because you were celebrating." So that's one of the experiences. That's one of the experiences of my life, I have to say. The fact they didn't lose and all that as well. So it was a moral victory. They played brilliantly. Simon Donnelly was immense. Simon was just, that was when he just came in the team. He was superb. There was a lot of them played really well that day. Faulkner and all that. You actually thought, God, there's maybe a bit more about this team.
Did you get the impression that they felt they deserved, or the Celtic fans deserved the performance from them because of the way that everything was going at that point?
Possibly, because it was one of those kind of rare bright spots at the end of that. I mean, people forget what it was like now. You know, even I say to these guys, you know, the guys in Celtic media now, you don't know he's 11. I remember my first day as editor, Celtic lost in the Scottish Cup to Motherwell. That would have been 94. Tommy Coyne, the wind was howling and Tommy Coyne headed it in for Motherwell. Mm-hmm. So Celtic, essentially their season was over in January the 28th. You know, the season was over in January the 28th. We had 4 months to fill out the views.
Was that Fir Park?
I was at Fir Park.
Yeah, Carol Muddleton made an arse of going for the cross.
Yeah, he possibly did, although he was a better keeper than people. So people just judge him by the name and all that, you know. He was a lovely guy as well, but that's the problem. I remember speaking to Davy Hay, and it was like, because Celtic played such brilliant football under Tommy in that 8-in-a-row season. They actually gained more points than they did when they actually won it stop 10-in-a-row. You know, their points hole. But Rangers were very good that season as well. That was the best Rangers out of the nine, in terms of when it was Gascoigne and Loudrup really bringing it in. You know, but I remember saying to Davy, I said, "What's wrong with this team? They play brilliant football. They could have easily won this league." I said, "You know what's wrong?" He said, "The C factor's missing." You know, it was it always struck me. Because as soon as O'Neill assembled that team, with Lennon, Sutton, Thompson, Hartson, there was an abundance of that factor. It was a totally different team. They played on the edge in a way that they bullied teams in the way that Celtic had been bullied.
No, I remember being at Ibrox once when we were having a victory and thinking, I love Sutton. And I love Lennon, and I love Thompson. And if I supported any other team in Scotland, those would be the three players that I would hate most.
Yeah. Oh, undeniably. Undeniably. They knew how to play on the edge. And as I say, that was very un-Celtic in its own way. But it was what was required at the time. They've got a mix of both, probably, the current team. You know,
I actually felt in the signings that Lennon made in the summer, and certainly the team selections he was doing right at the beginning of the season, he was picking strong men. Yeah. You know, he was signing people who were tall and they were physical. El Hamed and Foster. And I thought, yeah, he's making sure we've got a team that's not going to lose games. That's what he's building here. Because we've got enough creativity. On the changeover, you talked earlier about it was very difficult when Fergus first came in. I mean, I remember you know, the elation I can still remember, you know, because it's the days before social media when it finally happened. And obviously there's the famous shots outside Celtic Park, the guy with the Haddo's poly bag in his head. You don't see people wearing poly bags in their heads for hats these days in rainy weather. And I always remember that, and phoning friends at 11 o'clock at night. You know, you don't phone people's landlines at 11 o'clock at night to say, have you heard the news? And then we had the game against St Johnstone at Perth, and then we lost to Motherwell in the first game back at Celtic Park. And I remember at that day thinking, the team was shite before Fergus. No, you know, why did you think it was suddenly going to change, that the team would start winning? That was the day that I realised this was not going to be, we've got Fergus McCann and everything's going to be perfect 3 days later, that it was going to be a long turnaround that lots of other supporters obviously didn't.
He was really, there was 40,000 turned up that day. You thought, wow. And then the next home game, it almost went straight back to the attendance was very similar to what had been pre-takeover. And he's going, hey, where are those 70,000 people? Hey, you thought they wanted this and all this. You know, that was as dumped as, actually, when I'm thinking back, like, God, you're triggering off memories. He was really dumped thinking, wow, unless you give them something instant, they don't want, you know what I mean? They're not going to stand by you.
And that's when I get annoyed when the few people who still are critical of Fergus say, what money did he put in? He stood and underwrote the share issue. I bet everybody knew that share issue would be a success. No, they fucking didn't. He was needing something like 75% of our average support to buy shares for it to work.
And remember, there was a great story about that. We thought it was going to be a disaster. Everybody thought it was going to be a disaster because he opened it up about 2 weeks before Celtic lost to Raith Rovers in the League Cup final. And I remember going to speak to him the next morning. We'd set aside 12 pages. Like we'd no material. Set aside 12 pages. Thought, this will be the first win in 5.5 years. Oh, this will be brilliant. And it's like, the Sunday night and all that, we're all looking at each other, Merrill and all that, like, Joseph, what the hell are we going to put in the view? It was like, get Lee Martin's coming back for his leg break. That can be a spread. You know, it was all these things. We were just making up things on the hoof because we had nothing to put in. It's like, why did I do that to myself? And then when it came to with all this gash copy, as you might call it, when it came to the Airdrie one, 6 months later, we had it ready. If the worst happened. But the next morning, I remember after that League Cup final, going in to see Fergus, said, we'll need to get something from Fergus. I said, Fergus, are you thinking about delaying the share issue now? He says, no. Why would I? I said, do you know, there's just something, because he bore the brunt of it. It wasn't Tommy bore the brunt of it for losing that League Cup final. It was Paul, maybe, and Fergus. People suddenly heap the blame onto him. I said, people think you don't care enough. You know, there's no an emotional connection. Hey, I'm sweating bullets here. I always remember him using that phrase because I thought that's a great tabloid line, you know. Like, people think I don't care, I'm sweating bullets, you know. And see his wee face, he didn't want to be kind of told you so. But see that night when it was oversubscribed by nearly 100%, we went down to get him. Michael Kelly had written a piece in one of the papers saying, this will be a disaster. He's bitten off more than he can chew. He doesn't understand the Celtic sport and all that. And I said to Joe, go down and get Fergus to bite back at Michael Kelly. And he didn't want to. He says, he laughed at me and he says, hey, the dog barks, but the caravan moves on. You know, this was like, and I said, we've got to get that on the front page. He says, he didn't want to use it. I said, Joe, go back. And he's like, come on. God, you know, throw us a bone here. Never mind the dog barking. Throw us a bone here. So we eventually got him to put it in. The dog barks, but the caravan moves on, you know.
You know, listening to you talking, you sound like you get real affection for Fergus. I mean, I love the man. I think there should be a statue outside Celtic Park. I think the North Stand should be the Fergus McCann Stand. I remember Jock Brown had said, after Brother Walfred and Jock Steen, in years to come, Fergus McCann will be up there. I remember Hugh Keevans deriding that comment and wanting to put my fist through the radio and punch his lights out because I I thought, no, Jock Brown's right. Fergus McCann in years to come will be up there. It's a pantheon of a great person at the club. And it sounds like you've got fantastic affection for him.
No, definitely not. Look, I mean, he was hard work. His intransigence was just knew no bounds. And he wasn't necessarily one to kind of acknowledge he got it wrong, but he was a fascinating, inscrutable, but fascinating character. But I wrote a piece in the Evening Times. I'd gone to the Evening Times by that time that Jock made that statement. And everybody, he was getting slaughtered in the papers. I said, can I write a column saying Jock's right? And they said, oh, aye, definitely. So I wrote this thing saying, like, there was nothing he said here that really jars. And my relationship with Jock had gone south almost immediately. Jock had said that, you know what I mean, he would take my calls about checking transfer stuff and all that. And then about 2 days later, it came out about, I didn't want it. I knew that there was this thing about, you know, the schism between Janssen and Hay and Brown, you know, and how Janssen loved Hay and he couldn't be bothered with Brown because he saw him as part of his football coterie and Jock was an outsider and how they didn't get on and all this kind of stuff and how I knew about the clause in his contract that he could leave after a year and all this, but I wasn't going to go. I had to sign a confidentiality agreement with Celtic when I left, so I wasn't going to go the next week and say, spill my guts with all these things. I thought, so it came out in another paper and the Evening Times weren't too happy. I said, look, now that it's come out, I'll write about it because if it's out there, I'll write about it. So I wrote about how the relationship had never been good and how he's sneering of Brown and all that. And Jock had said to me 2 days before this, you can phone me any time to check journal, you know, check any transfer speculation or whatever, you know, I'll tell you the truth. And then the next day there was a press conference and I was walking down the stairs, Jock was at the top of the stairs and he said, Andrew, I Jock, and I knew what I'd written the day before, I Jock, he went, don't ever phone me. I was like, okay, Jock. The thing is, this is the problem, I don't necessarily have great contacts in the game, but I think the way you have to compromise yourself to get the contacts, it's not worth it. It's a bit like you, there's other bloggers that you could probably be closer to the club if you're willing to toe certain lines that other people do. But then you just become a mouthpiece. I don't understand why you'd ever want to run a website or a blog or whatever and no have your independence. No have your complete independence. I just don't understand why you'd surrender that for an in at the club.
You know, it's funny you should say that because I, every so often, you know, I have a proper job. So every so often I do stuff which has a wee bit more involvement with people at the club, or, you know, when we did an interview with Peter Lawwell. So every so often I get a flavour of what it must be like. It's why I have much more sympathy for journalists the more I've done this. I have a flavour of what it must be like to be a journalist. And in terms of the way people criticise you for saying stuff that you know 100% to be true, but it's not what they want to hear. And then, you know, in terms of if you say something like, going back to what I said earlier, when I said, hey, if you think Peter's bad, I'd have fired him, right? Because people say, why are you saying that? Who? And you can hardly say, right, okay, because I know this guy, and by coincidence, I know this guy, and they've all told me this information, because because you would never get that information again from people.
Yep.
And
I know.
And then secondly, the other thing is, the minute you write, the world is not black and white. So the minute you write a piece that you actually say, do you know what, see, these circumstances, I completely agree with, because you've heard a wee bit of stuff, I completely agree with what the board have said or what Peter Lawwell said. Are you just a lapdog to the board? You're only saying that because you want to be in with them. No, actually, it's just my opinion and you're only saying that because you'll not get anything else. No, because actually I don't get anything from the club anyway. I don't ever want to get sucked into the world of having to owe people favours or having to do anything, yep. And at times I think it must be really challenging to operate as a journalist, because how do you tread that line? How can you be Neil Lennon's best pal to get all the stories and then write a piece if Neil Lennon mucks up on the team selection against Rangers? How can you then write a piece slaughtering him?
No, you have to retain a safe distance, and that maybe doesn't get you the news lines, or the news exclusives quite the same way. But you have your integrity and you have your independence, and what genuinely governs what everything I do is a genuine desire to be fair and a genuine desire to just say what I think, and it's like I've probably been more critical. It's like for all Celtic supporters think that the press are not very favourable towards them. They're not that unfavourable towards them. They're never that unfavourable towards them now. It's like I'm probably more critical of the Green Brigade, you know, straight out writing pieces about, because I just can't be bothered with ultras. I'll be, you know what I mean, cards on the table. I just can't stand this kind of hierarchy that the ultra is somehow a better supporter than another guy who sits in the Jockstein or something like that, who doesn't kind of sing and like let off fireworks like a Wayne or something like that, you know, so my standpoint in the Green Brigade is a pretty kind of negative one, straight up. I'll be honest about that. I mean, I've just done certain Celtic Rangers games or Rangers Celtic games where I've just actually chronicled every single song that's been sung. I got some abuse for that a couple of years ago, but people tell you that didn't happen. No, I know it did happen. And I thought, I made a point about maybe a year and a half ago, that I wasn't just going to let it slide. If I heard things from both sides, I was going to put them in my match reports. So I did it for like Kenny Miller getting called Sad Orange B. I did it at the League Cup final. I was nearly calling it the Coca-Cola Cup final. It must have been that reference to Raith Rovers earlier on. with the Derek McInnes thing. I mean, this whole idea that Celtic fans, I did it when Celtic fans are singing Roman the Gloaming and all that at Thistle a couple of months ago. This whole idea that they're no sectarian, that's right out the window. That is right out the window. There's a section of them that are exhibiting sectarian tendencies. You know, so that's all you can be governed by. What you think's right and what you think's fair. You know, that's all I was wanting. I had this Rangers sport on me said, you're much more critical of Rangers than you are of Celtic. I said, have you noticed? I said, Celtic have won the last, they've won the last 10 trophies. Rangers haven't won anything. They've been posting profits, Celtic, winning all these trophies. And Rangers have been racking up these losses after the old version of them was liquidated. How can you, you just want it, because you say one thing or one, you've got to be, that isn't fairness. That would be blind ignorance of the situation, you know.
But then that's the thing that I was saying earlier about, you know, I every so often through a podcast or something I've written, dip my toe close to the world that you guys live in. And if you don't write what people want to hear, you're either making it up, you're talking nonsense, or you're an arsehole.
Yeah. I mean,
On your Celtic Rangers stuff, one of the other things I recall about you was it was a super scoreboard. And it must have been when you got the job in the Times or maybe when you got the job at the Scotland on Sunday or whatever it was. And I remember Graeme Spears congratulating you. And he said, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but they're pretty much this. He said, that makes it 24-5. And whoever was presenting said, well, what do you mean? Well, there's 24 ex-Rangers employees now writing in the press and there's now 5 Celtic. And it actually then led to a conversation between him and Hugh Keevans about the fact that the sports writers invariably voted for a Rangers player to win Player of the Year because there was more Rangers fans who were sports writers. It was the most honest, open conversation I'd ever heard. I think it was one of those Saturdays when maybe neither Celtic nor Rangers were playing. Maybe we were playing. Right. So it was almost as if they thought they could get away with it because no one was listening. It was one of those.
And I don't think there's not as many Rangers, probably people that work in the Rangers. People haven't been going so much from the Rangers News and Celtic View. It used to be a kind of quite a procession. There's so few jobs in football journalism now that people tend to rarely move on. Like there's some cuts made and some people lose their jobs horribly. But the whole idea that there's this new blood comes in. We're getting older. We're collectively getting much older. Mm-hmm. In the sense that there's not many people under 30. And I remember I didn't get my job in the Times until I was 30 and I thought I was finished. I thought I was never getting out of Celtic. There's been a lot of times I wished I was coming back, but at that time, you know, you just wanted to I remember saying to Wim Janssen, Wim Janssen said, why are you leaving? And I jokingly said, I said, for the money. Because my wages went for something like 15,000 to something like 24,000. And I was 20 hours fewer. So I was like, I was earning something like $9,000 more for 20 fewer hours working. You know, something you can do in your 20s, you'd work without any dependence or whatever. You'd work all the days that God sends. I mean, at one time, Donald had me working 29 days in a row in the Celtic View. And I said to him, Donald, I need a day off. You know, I need a day off. And it was like, that was at the time when I started, we got paid in brown envelopes, swear to God, on a Thursday. It was like Cracker Jack. It was 5:05. Jack would make the call to the secretary at Celtic View. He can come over and pick up the envelopes now. And we'd run over, somebody would run over and get all our envelopes. And my first wage was, when I started at Celtic View, it was 7,800, which actually wasn't that bad as a kind of graduate wage. And,
In 89, yeah.
It was definitely competitive with the kind of market rates. He said, don't worry. He said, within 6 months, if you settle here, we'll put your wages up. And then 4 years later, I was still on 7,800. But so I always forget, you know, like that wee square brown envelope, you know, like, and it, the wee kind of slip in it and how much it was. It was £115. I always remember that. So I was clearing £150 and it felt like I could do anything. I could buy all the records I wanted. You know, I could just go, could go out all the time. And it's like you think, I can't believe I could do all that and that money. And now I can't, and you don't get buying the money you've got now, you know.
So very quickly, because I've kept you long enough, and actually, as we've been talking, I've been thinking there needs to be. I need to do another podcast. I need to do another one because there's so much for you to chat about Jock Brown, Wim Janssen, and all that stuff. So, but we've obviously got to talk about just now and today. And what do you make of the Dundee debacle? What the hell is going on?
Well, yeah, you'll have noticed it, that your brethren from across the city think this is it. This is the exposed the kind of Lowell runs Scottish football narrative. I don't know if you saw the WhatsApp, the shared WhatsApp messages from the Dundee secretary, Eric Drysdale. I mean, it's very murky. It's very murky. But I'll tell you what I do think happened. And this isn't what people want to hear, because this makes it a lot more innocent kind of chaos than has maybe been suggested. Dundee sent in their vote, but for some reason it didn't land. Now, we also know that Hearts had a problem with their vote landing. So the SPFL look at it at 5 o'clock and think, wow, Dundee haven't voted? They must be having second thoughts. Because everybody knew by Friday morning the proposal was going down because three championship clubs are going to go up, vote against it. I'd said it, I'd written it in the Thursday morning as well. It was going down because we couldn't get the necessary 75% majority in the championship. So when the SPFL see that, wow, it's 5 o'clock, and they only voted. Jeez, they're stalling. They must be stalling because they're having second thoughts. Get on the phone to them and see if we can convince them to second thoughts and change what their mind was. Something must have happened. Maybe it is the Americans that own them. So, as is his fiduciary duty, you might say, Doncaster says, well, I recommended this. Me, as chair of this board, recommended this. So, therefore, I want it to go through. So, I'm entitled to lobby a club that I think can get this through, because I think it's for the benefit of Scottish football. I don't agree with any of that, right? But I appreciate he's allowed to do that. So he phones up. John Nelms. John Nelms says, what? He hasn't realised the vote hasn't gone through. He says, well, if you haven't, you know, so obviously the conversation, well, if you haven't voted, can I just impress upon you again why you shouldn't vote that way you were going to vote?
Mm-hmm.
So an opportunity.
To which he's then going to say,
jeez.
Right, okay, and he's going to be thinking, I've got some breathing space here.
Yeah.
I will give it some thought, and I'll discuss it again with my colleagues.
Yeah, so what happened was, the SPFL thought there was an opportunity, But when they thought there was an opportunity, there shouldn't. There wasn't really an opportunity. But then erroneously thinking there was an opportunity created an opportunity. Because once they went, it just doesn't, as they always say these days, the old cliche, the optics are terrible. It doesn't look good, does it?
The only thing that somebody said to me, they shouldn't have then said what the vote was.
They shouldn't. That's what I was just about to say. That's very, very naughty. Because the SPFL, you can only get what day of the week it is out them most times. So they put out an incomplete vote, and then we're all running around. You know, we're all running, who is it? And we quickly find out, you know, because we're all writing it for the paper the next day or our websites right away. So the pressure was then on, and they're thinking, what? So that was very, very, I don't think in any way, shape or form that was correct to put out an incomplete ballot.
Yeah, I mean, the easy thing would have been to say, we've had some technical issues receiving all the votes, and we're just clarifying some matters with some clubs.
Yes, yeah, because we knew, because I put it in the paper on the Friday morning, we knew it didn't have to be, you know, the Companies Act 2006 means that if you have a written resolution, your members have 28 days to adopt or reject. So that nobody had to vote by 5 p.m. It's just a request so they can get it done quickly. And clearly, if they're thinking everybody needs, the people need the kind of central prize monies, then they don't want to wait 28 days.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of this proposal, which I think is the wrong proposal. I have to say I'm disappointed that Celtic voted for the proposal. I'm disappointed that people want it, because I think this season should be finished whenever it's finished. I know that you say about the TV deal, I've still got my suspicions over that one, you know.
The issue is, and I have every sympathy. I mean, the point I keep making to any time a Rangers fan has a go at me, point I keep making is, look, we are going to win the league. That's unless we have a run of form that's worse in the remaining 8 games, that's worse than Hearts has been all season. And unless Rangers suddenly turn into, I used the phrase earlier, Brazil 1970, we are winning the league, right? So that's...
Everybody knows that.
So we are winning the league. And we... So effectively then, if you discount that, we are 2 wins away from a quadruple treble. So the people who are missing out most in the short term of calling this, in terms of the masses, would be the Celtic support. Because we will miss being able to be there to celebrate winning the 9th title in a row, and we will miss being there, probably a 60% chance that we will win a quadruple treble.
I know. Well, I would say, mind you, that maybe Thistle and Hearts would respectfully disagree that their support might have a lot more to lose through this.
They've got stuff to lose, but in terms of missing...
Missing
something to celebrate. There's no interest to us to call the league, to call things as they are, because we're going to win the league and we're highly likely to win the cup. So it's not...
I've taken Rangers' side right through all this in recent days. I think I don't know about the competence of their resolution, but it seems all a bit something going on, something bubbling up behind the scenes there. And I think they were right to vote against it. I think them and Hearts were right to vote against it. I think they're right. There should be a mechanism to pay out the prize money without calling the season. Now, their motives might be questionable, but actually, the stance they've taken in all these matters, and it was a fiasco. This is a fiasco, this whole vote thing, which they said yesterday. And there does need to be an investigation. So I want that put in the record that I'm on Rangers' side on this.
You know, the thing I did wonder, you're saying about criticising Celtic there, the thing I did wonder is one of the more straightforward solutions, if you have to have the league finished by the 1st of August, one of the more straightforward solutions that minimises negative impact would be to call the league in terms of prizes, in terms of who's won the league, and have no relegation, and have a bigger top tier.
Yeah, I think that.
And I wondered if Celtic's motivation is Celtic don't want a 14-team top league or a 16-team or whatever they would move to try and have a top league.
Yeah, see, that's what everybody says. People are now saying that there's more of an appetite for that. This 11-1, I cannot see any expansion of the league getting 11-1 in favour of it. I just can't see it. Can't see it because it dilutes the pot. You know, it would probably open up for the teams at the bottom. It would open up the chances of them missing out in games against home game gates against Celtic or Rangers, of having a drifting kind of post-split period to this season, which would also be longer. You know, it would be more than just 5 games. It would be more like 14 games. You know, or the 10 games. You know, that's what it'd be, whether it was the 8 or the 6, the way they split it. I just cannot see that. I cannot see that flying. I'd like it to, because I think I think there's enough clubs now. I think clubs in general have become a wee bit stronger, just in terms of the infrastructure and such like.
I mean, for me personally, the size of Scotland, the optimum size would be either, I've always thought, something like a 16-team top flight, a 10-team second tier. That's your professional clubs, and everything else is a regional pyramid system underneath. It's something, or an 18-team top flight, a 10-team second flight, and then everything else. Basically, instead of spreading the money against 42 clubs, you spread it within a core of somewhere around 30, 20, 30 clubs.
Maybe 28 clubs or something.
And I've thought for years that would then make part of the reason why teams can't compete with Celtic and Rangers is because they've got too many games against Celtic and Rangers. If you had Aberdeen who could play, or Hibs or whoever, who played 7-8 games before they played Celtic, and then another 8-9 games before they played, 7-8 games before they played Rangers, where they're playing lesser teams and could actually win more games.
Yeah.
And create more momentum, as was demonstrated when there was no Rangers and Aberdeen actually stayed closer to us, because there was only one, it was a one horse race, and so they were able to beat everybody else.
I know, and it would also, I suppose, it definitely would. It does complicate matters.
But anyway, I've kept you long enough. I would like, if at all possible, I think we need to have another one. To cover some more of your stories.
No, look, whatever you think, as long as
Michael Kelly doesn't sue you again.
What's that?
Michael Kelly doesn't sue you again.
I've got a few other ones, but I'll tell you that some other time.
Right. Well, with that, Andrew, or should I just call you H?
No, don't. It's gone. It's retired. H is retired.
Bring me some. After listening to that, I'm sure you'll understand why I'm going to get Andrew back on the podcast. I'm sure, in fact, I know there are more Fergus tales, there are more Old Board tales, and there are tales after his time at Celtic. Anyway, I hope you're looking after yourself. It can be challenging times to not have your daily routine, to be in this lockdown period, to not be meeting the people that you love best. We've also got the nonsense going on in Scottish football just now, where Rangers with their Trump-style PR. And it's a difficult thing to combat. This is Scottish football's fight against Rangers. People seem to be forgetting in all of the hullabaloo that the majority of football clubs want this proposal of the SPFL to go through, and it can be difficult for everybody to fight the crazy Trump-style PR machine that is currently Rangers. And it's not Celtic's fight to get involved in, because it just makes it a simple Celtic Rangers thing. Anyway, enough of me. Please take care of yourself. Please go on the Celtic FC Foundation website. If you've got a penny to spare, look up the Football for Good Fund and the fantastic work they're doing for the NHS staff and for local food banks. And if you are fortunate position that you're not worried about your own position, then see if you can contribute. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, Andrew Smith, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me.